This is GamesAtWork.biz with Phaedra Boinodiris, Michael Martin, and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone, and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with. This is episode 130, The Final Countdown. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Michael Rowe here on the final day, the final recording, not the final day, I lied, but it's the final recording of 2015 of GamesAtWork.biz with my wonderful and fantastic co-hosts, Phaedra Boinodiris.
Hey, how are you, Michael? Good to hear your voice. It's been a while.
Ditto, ditto.
And we are also joined by Michael Martin. So it's the three of us today. Woo! Three co-hosts.
The
last
three
show co-hosts. Of 2015.
I like it. All recording from different places, but we are together in voice.
They said it would never happen.
So I hope everyone has had a very holly and delightful and joyous couple of few days as we are here on, 2 days away for the end of the year.
Yes.
And while we're not going to talk about it in any kind of detail, I am very happy to know now that, Michael, you've joined the $1 billion or so dollars that have been spent. Actually, it's more than that now on Star Wars. And can now join us as a pod person.
Yes. I can't remember, though, if I decided to go for the light mascara or the dark mascara.
Luckily,
maybe it's Maybelline.
Maybe it's Maybelline. Yes. Well, so I'm really pleased about that. And one of the things that we had kind of found for our show today was a really helpful hint from BBC News about how to avoid Star Wars, because I don't know how you did it, Michael, lasting as long as you did until today, with avoiding all the social media, the spoilers, everything related to Star Wars. How did you do it?
Whenever I talked to anyone or saw anything that said Star Wars, I shut them up. Or I moved on.
You walked around with a roll of duct tape.
Well, pretty close. And Michael knows exactly what I'm talking about.
I did. It was like, oh, I have something funny. And he's like, it was really funny. We did like the whole zip it thing, you know, www.zipit.com.
You got it. You got it. It was a hard battle to take, too. I mean,
yeah.
Because I wanted to know, but I didn't want to know, you know?
Well, see, the thing, I know, but the thing
totally
is,
know what you mean, you know?
How do you know you don't want to know when you know that you should know, but you knew you didn't want to know in the first place?
Well, now I know, you know?
Well, now you know. I found that there are a number of places that you don't expect Star Wars information to come at you.
Yes.
Like, say, for example, in the chat, in-game chat for some games.
Yes, I saw something in there and I thought it was, you know, I just ignored it because I thought it was a comment like, you know, hand shot first, right? I mean, old reference, but somebody made a comment in one of the games, and I just completely ignored it.
Well,
and it was a spoiler.
It was a spoiler. So yes, we're not going to go do that ourselves.
No.
But I think, you know, with, again, over $1 billion spent worldwide on this, you probably can take the filter off of your Google Chrome environment. You can probably, you know, begin to walk the street again. And when the T-shirts of, you know, start coming out with the various sayings on them, you will be able to still look people in the eye and say, yeah, I know.
Yeah, but, I think the point there is, though, I know people who have seen it 3 or 4 times already, and it's only been out like 11 days. Wow. So part of that billion is not all new people.
No, that's true, and there will probably be many more who go and see it again and again and again. Are you one of those people, Phaedra? Do you go see a movie like multiple times in the theater, or not so much?
Not so much. And this one, I feel, I don't know, somewhat ambivalent. And I know this is going to get me a lot of criticisms, but I see some problems with the plot line.
I'm probably going to see it a couple more times in the theater because today was in plain 2D mode, and I want to see it in
you know, IMAX 3D. And then we promised my mother-in-law that we would go with her to see it. So,
and we promised Andy a review.
Yes.
Actually, we didn't promise him anything.
He asked for a review.
Doing a review today?
Nope. No.
We will do a year in review of the review a year from now's review.
But only if we have a pre-review meeting.
Yes. A pre-meeting meeting for the review.
All right. So here's something we can talk about. So Phaedra, you found this really cool Kickstarter approach that if you want to be playing your Star Wars game and with your laser blasters and Star Wars Battlefront, and you want to just take out all those stormtroopers and you don't want to use some lousy little plasticky thingy or, God forbid, the controller that came with your console device, you can pack some real heat based on this Kickstarter. So tell us how you found it and what do you think about it?
Yeah, well, this story caught my attention because I have a five-year-old, and he's gotten really into the world of Skylanders. And so for those who don't know what this is basically, think of it as a platform that you connect to your console, where you've got these little figurines, and based on which figurines you put on the platform, they show up in the game, right? So Lego and Disney have now expanded on this approach to think of it as a console evolution or integration, right? So Lego came out with something called Lego Dimensions, where you actually build these environments using Legos that have sensory devices. And then you not only have these little figurines, again, that you build, but you can create these Batmobiles and different machinery and vehicles that these figures can all drive. And when you put them on the platform, they show up in the game. So I'm just seeing this tremendous merging between the worlds of the real and the digital, you know, and I think what's happening with these different companies is, they're fantastic examples. The Kickstarter campaign is specifically for first person shooters. The airsoft gun business has just really been exploding. They've been getting, just a tremendous amount of interest in the way that you can modify your air gun today, you can drop an enormous amount of money from, you know, different kinds of sensory devices to having it tricked out in different ways, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what's happening now is you can actually purchase, adapters for your airsoft guns, these attachments that, can actually be used so that it can be used as a controller within your first person shooter game, right? So the more tricked out your rail gun is in real life, when you attach these sensory devices, you can bring in that same digitized version of that weapon within your favorite first person shooter. So again, interesting, the blending of the two worlds.
Well, that's awesome. I for the holidays, I got Battlefront, which would be perfect to go to your illusion there, Michael, on Battlefront, because playing it with a mouse and a keyboard, I'm not very good at it. But if I had a gun,
you could tear it up.
I could tear it up because it's very cool.
So hopefully you're enjoying Battlefront, because I know a number of people who have been playing it for a while have really, really liked it. I've not personally played, but what do you think, Michael? Good?
Well, when I first installed it, I was having it crash all the time. And my gaming rig, you know, it's not brand new, but it's still pretty well high-end. And I finally found a blog post that pointed to a YouTube video that showed the settings to change, because I guess they're optimized for certain video cards only. It's fun. I'm not a PvP person, and pretty much the whole game is designed around PvP, even if it's a PvE, right? Player versus environment, but the environment in this case is just hordes and hordes of the bad guy, depending on whether the bad guy is the light or the dark, right, side. I'm getting used to it. I've never, even when I used to play Dances with Wookiees, I was never good at space battles. And there's you know, when you're doing the battle for Hoth, you want to take the flyer around and and shoot down other flyers and as well as take down the Imperial walkers. And so I haven't played it enough to say it's awesome, but it's gorgeous. It's a gorgeous looking game. The mechanics taking me a little while to get used to, but I'm really enjoying it.
That's so cool. And I'm getting the idea that Dimensions has entered your household, Fader. Is that true?
Indeed. Santa. Under the tree. So, yes, we've got Ninjangos and Batmans and all kinds of little characters on this platform. So we're having fun with it. All good.
Yeah, no, that was something we talked about actually last episode, and we had some great fun just imagining what that was going to be like, especially having Scooby-Doo and Doctor Who, for example.
It wasn't quite here's what I was thinking it would be. I thought each Lego piece would have a sensor device, right? So that whatever you built, if you built a tower on the platform, which I think, is it that far of a leap technologically? Just a little tiny sensor on each one. It ups the cost.
Super tiny little Internet of Things. I mean, if you're having like a one, you know, or two or six, you know, block, you know, that you're collecting together, I would imagine that is going to be a bigger leap forward than to be able to say, oh, okay, Wonder Woman's invisible jet goes on this base.
Yeah.
And even if you don't build anything on that base, but put the base on the Dimensions stage, it's going to play, right?
Right. Again, hats off to Lego for just being awesome.
Well, they are, and we are huge fans of Lego, and that kind of relates us to our next story that, Fader, you and I talked about very, very briefly when we were last together, and that was about what Lego is thinking about with playing games at work. They've actually come up with a consulting business called Serious Play. That's the terminology that they've used for it, and they're pulling together consulting services, Lego blocks, and, you know, not just like red and green bricks, you know, it's much more complex than that, to help facilitate how people need to bring play into work and allow for the creativity that Lego has delivered for children for such a long time to be part of the adult world too.
We're big proponents.
No.
We concur.
No, you're kidding.
I don't know. Although they did take our show title, Games at Work. But
I know.
No, but so tell me more about how exactly, and I remember we talked about this a bit before, and you mentioned that they had different kinds of kits. Talk a little bit more about the different kinds of kits, you know, to inspire innovation.
Yeah, well, the way that I see them right now is that these kits have lots of different bricks and blocks in them. If I were to go under one of my kids' beds, I probably could pull up a very similar set as to what they're delivering. And the consultants, or they're more, it almost seems like they're play facilitators. Let's just call it that. They use the language.
Play facilitators?
Maybe is an Imagineer kind of builder thingy, you know, it's awesome. Everything's awesome, right? They have this idea of build it or play it out, right? So that's the language that they use, build it or play it out. So if you are able to build something, I guess it's very much like when you think about Pictionary, you can describe it. If you can draw it, you can imagine it, you can do something with it. So if you can use the bricks and pull it together in a way that makes sense. Michael, what was that game that we had too? Life of George? Is that the one?
Yes, Lego's Life of George.
Yeah, so that was kind of a fun thing there too, where it was very much like Pictionary, except that you were given something to build with a timer to build it, and then you had to snap a picture of it using your cell phone, and then you would be graded as to whether or not you built it according to what the picture says. Is a Tanga or something, I think, was similar to this too, where you would do that with shapes. and Slack is going crazy in my ears here, going with all the new things. But Phaedra, I think that's really the crux of the matter, is that this is a method of problem solving where you're being asked to, instead of draw something on the board or maybe do the visual note taking that we've seen in other data visualization kind of structures before, but rather to build it in three dimensions or even two dimensions using the bricks, and then having everybody's heads focused in on the same thing together versus, you know, I'm working in my space, you work in yours. I mean, right. At least that's what I'm taking away from it.
And there was another a card game that I came across too that I've seen being sold. I think it's called Disruptor or Disruption, something like that. Also meant it's entertainment, but I could totally see us using it in the office. You know, how it is that you spur innovation of different ideas. You have to blend two different things and talk about how you're going to introduce it to the market. Blah 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 blah. So I like it. I like the idea of these, of ways of being able to introduce these mechanisms to help foster ideas.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Mm-hmm.
So looking forward to seeing more about this. And like I said before, I do plan on buying the very simple $30 pack just to kind of get mm-hmm. a sense of what it is that they do. But I'm intrigued to understand, you know, how the bigger packs work. And shoot, you know, I'm planning on just leaving the bricks around at one of our, you know, work tables and see what happens as people just pick them up and use them.
Awesome. Cool. Good idea.
So these are great ways to educate and to facilitate knowledge acquisition and being more inventive and creative. And kind of speaking of which, Fader, you did find another article from the computer science education part of the U.S. Department of Education about the STEM Act of 2015. And we were all kind of scratching our heads just a smidge when we read through this post. So you want to lead us in this conversation?
We were definitely scratching our heads. And the reason is because there was some statistics that came out regarding the lack of students who were actually taking the AP Comp Sci exam. They were saying in 3 states, 0 female students had taken it. About 8 boys had taken it in those same 3 states. But the Department of Ed had also come out saying that just about anybody could teach a computer science class, including an English teacher, history teacher, civics teacher. You don't have to have any background in math and science. And I was just curious when I saw it. I was kind of like, "What?"
So do they need a background in logic or in thinking or in understanding complex problems?
They don't say. They leave it very, very open ended. But I'll tell you, I've been meeting with numerous middle school and high school students recently because of a project of mine. And it is so few and far between the students who understand any level of programming or coding, even in high school, just, you know, it's just rare. And I'm just puzzled. I'm really, really puzzled as to why we're still at this point. I was just curious if you've noticed.
I am completely flabbergasted by we've gotten to the point in technology, at least with computer technology now, where the kind of like cars did, right? For the longest time, you had to be a very expert specialist to build and make and repair cars, and then it became kind of an expected skill and understanding. And now with connected vehicles and Internet of Things cars, etc., we're back into that specialization mode. And I think we're going to go through that same cycle with programming, because I look at some of the, you know, the newer programming languages that are really designed to have the computer do most of the type checking, the safety type stuff to make sure that you're not overriding in, you know, memory that you're not supposed to be addressing, the things that if you understand the basics of programming, I don't care about the language, right? Understanding how computers work and then how to program a computer, regardless of language, regardless of, you know, object-oriented or procedural or functional or whatever, right? We're getting to that stage where that stuff is kind of abstracted away, and we're trying to get to the point where we're saying that programming is just the ability of stringing things together
logically.
Yeah. Logically. Yeah. But not even necessarily logically, because in object-oriented programming, in any type of, you know, graphical environment where you're dealing with objects that react to things instead of a structured logical progression of capability in a language or in a program, it changes the paradigm of how people need to understand and learn how to program. But I think we're going through that transition right now where people think they know more than they do. and we see this with a lot of the security vulnerabilities where people go, well, I was programming in best practices, but they didn't understand the underlying way that computers and technology and the network stack, et cetera, work. And so we haven't bridged that gap yet to where it can just easily be picked up. That's why when I saw the post that you posted, Fader, my first reaction was, please, Phaedra, don't say you agree with this. Please, Phaedra, don't say you agree with this.
Not to get too political, but right now I'm going to get a little bit political. So it's a question, I think, also of those people who know how to program could probably get a higher paying job somewhere else than not being a teacher. You know what I mean? Maybe that's what the issue is. I mean, maybe it's just a question of the teachers are woefully underpaid within this country. And so the people who are there to teach comp sci just, they don't have the background. Maybe that's what it is.
Well, you may remember, it wasn't that long ago where music teachers, for example, were recruited to move into programming.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right? Because the concept of how musical notation and logic, I'll go back to that, object-oriented or not, helps one develop the same kind of mathematical skills that are necessary to be an effective developer and programmer.
Well, it's interesting because think about it. Music notation is an abstraction, which a lot of the object-oriented programming languages are abstractions, which is great. Understanding that level.
And so is grammar. I mean, if you've done French or Russian or Chinese, you know, these are all abstractions of taking thought and giving voice to those thoughts and making them slightly more concrete, but they are only a model of what the thought was to begin with.
But the difference there is, yes, a English first language speaker who is a French teacher, I think, has a better understanding of that abstraction from a programming modeling perspective than an English first language speaker who teaches English.
Maybe. I don't know. I'd be willing to say that a really good English teacher whose first language is English, native tongue is English, would probably, if they're really good, have a command of the syntax and grammar in a way that even a foreign language native tongue person may not have. But on the flip side, you could have me in saying, well, that's exactly why the one whose mother tongue is something other than English will learn English better because they're not winging it by ear.
Yeah, but I'm actually looking at it from a different angle. I'm saying the thought process that you must develop to learn that second and or third language and understand their grammar as an abstraction of your standard speaking grammar would make you, again, this is just I posit this, right? Would make it easier for you to understand computer programming than if your only reference point is a language you speak natively.
I'll buy that. And I'll take you one further because we were kind of going down that path
one
and we
veered
away. No. I'm not going to the one step beyond piece. But where I am heading is that the level of abstraction, I think, is getting to such a point where people who are non-native developers are able to create pieces of functionality that will help them propel what they need to do in a computer world forward. And we've talked about this on our shows here multiple times in the past, ways of taking APIs, hooking them together, doing small macro kinds of pieces of work. And because of those small snippets, being able to be that much more effective and productive and able to move forward fast.
Mm. So, yeah. And I agree with that. That is what I would call a business user, not a programmer.
Well, it may be, but I mean, even if you're not a programmer, so my son, who is working with Pixelmator, which is definitely not a development environment, it's a drawing environment, has managed to configure without really any education other than just playing things around with it, watching a couple of YouTube videos, configure his new Wacom tablet to have one of the soft programmable buttons be Control-Z. And he just mapped that to one of them. So as he's drawing something, doesn't like it, presses that button, off he goes, next thing, because it's removed it, right? It did an undo for him. Boom. Very, very quick and very easy. and also figuring out how to do other keyboard shortcuts to replicate pieces of work or move quickly between applications. So his workflow has increased enormously quickly to the point where his grandmother is just absolutely flabbergasted how fast he learned these things.
Yeah, and that I think that's great. I applaud the application of those skills. I think that is definitely a business user.
Yeah.
Right?
Not programming.
But those skills don't yet translate to him creating the next version of Pixelmator.
No.
That's the difference. That's the nuance when I see computer science, right? Back to the article. It's about computer science programs. It's not about application using. And computer science requires a fundamental understanding of the science of computing, not just the ability to write macros and understand how to string APIs together.
Is your worry, Michael, that when you're stringing together the APIs and working with these macros, that in some way it fences people in? Like it's hard to think outside of the box if you're working with boxes?
No, I think there's a wonderful space to do that other stuff. Mm-hmm. But this article is very specific about advanced placement computer science classes. Right? This is about computer science. This would be like taking somebody who's really good at Legos and assuming that they can be a bridge engineer.
Yeah. I've been reading the comments for this article. If you guys have a chance, they're really, really interesting. Many, many, many people are writing in basically talking about their experience and what they've learned outside of school, right? How they became programmers. And so many people are largely self-taught, you know?
Yeah.
They ended up doing it themselves because they couldn't find people to teach them in the school setting, even in private schools.
But those people that become really good, they teach themselves the fundamentals, yeah. Right? They understand, you know, that our current modern day computers, for the most part, are binary systems, right? That there's a structure to the way the memory is stored and the way the memory is accessed, and that the way programs work and jump into different places in memory affects how they execute. The way an object is structured, that it has behaviors that it defines, data that it requires, or attributes or whatever, right? They learn those basic concepts. They may not learn them right away. They may stumble upon them. But to get to that next level of really being, again, and I'm being very picky about the term computer science.
Yeah, and right? Some of the comments in there are actually underscoring what you're talking about, yeah. Michael. So I get it. You know, business users who are accelerating their workflow is a business usage of the computer science, but the computer science had to be created in the first place.
Yep.
How did you create the API that people wanted to reuse? How did you create the concept of soft buttons? How did you enable a user experience that allows you to do the things that you want to do and then morph it into something better in the future? So
exactly.
I'm with you. I know exactly what you're trying to say here. And I'm seeing this too myself. I mean, one of my boys has been going through self-paced computer science education because that's all there is to offer. And at the high school level, you would think that there would be more of that in the United States right now. And it's unfortunate that there isn't.
It is unfortunate. Yeah. It is really unfortunate. It's already catching up with us.
Absolutely.
So moving along into something a little bit different, because I think we've exhausted that topic pretty well.
I can talk for a couple more hours on it if you want, but I won't.
Well, I'm sure you could, but I know you're going to be excited about this one too. So
hand shot first. No.
Oh. We've been talking about cars and connected cars, even in this show, not that long ago, a few minutes ago. And there is a company called Faraday Future. And I love all of these, you know, electrical kind of references, Tesla, Faraday, you know, so on and so forth. So Faraday Future is espousing the concept and idea. And we've kind of kicked this around here before too, that you don't need to buy a car in the future. You need to subscribe to a transportation service. And as we move more and more toward vehicles that are autonomous and can come to you when you need them, you may find that to get to work in the morning, you are happy getting to work in a pod. And when you come home in the afternoon, because you had to stop over at the lumber store, you need some 2x4s. You need to come home in something that is a truck that allows you to take those things home. And your subscription to your transportation service theoretically could be so flexible that you don't own anything. You're just buying a service, and that service meets you with your needs as you see them. And that's kind of my takeaway from this particular article from Tech Insider. And Michael, I was curious to get your sense on this. And, you know, knowing that you love cars as much as I do, is this a future you're looking forward to, or you're like, no?
Well, actually, it's interesting because the car industry as a whole has been struggling with this for the last really 5 years, right? With the rise of companies like Uber and Zipcar and Car2Go and all these other ones, right? Where the car as a service is becoming more important than the, you know, as we grew up, the freedom of owning a car, right? And so trying, as the industry as a whole tries to figure out what the right business models are in order to leverage this future, they're really going through a bunch of different models, right? And trying to figure it out. One of the things that you see, you know, the pod people, as you mentioned, the pod cars, that's the belief that you're providing a transportation service built around specific niche transportation requirements. So as you say, my trip to work, I may need a quiet pod so that I can finish up that last conference call before I start my day, or, you know, work on that one email that I have to get out before my boss comes in, right? Which is much more effective in a pod than driving down 75 miles an hour on the highway in my traditional car. So parsing out the service in such a way that it makes sense for people to pay for that service and the benefits that it provides is one route of going. The thing that I worry about on all these models, to be honest, is, and then I'll get back to why I like it too, is that we end up putting together a structure to where, because vehicles right now are so expensive, even, quote, low-end cars have become very, very expensive over the last 15, 20 years, that the service price may be too high to allow everyone to be able to afford, you know, their go-to-work pod. So you're still investing then in those traditional mass transit things and a secondary economy that's going to be built around old legacy vehicles, right? You know, think of the 57 Chevys in Cuba, right? But when I think about self-driving cars, regardless of the business model aspect, like you say, I love driving. I really do. But I know one day I will not be able to drive anymore. At least I hope I get that old. Right? And at that point, I still want the freedom of driving, which means self-driving cars, either as a service where I can go wherever I want and not have to pay for a cab, but I want the freedom of actually owning my self-driving car than paying for that service. So I think it's a logical thing, and I'm hoping to get a chance to see the Faraday concept vehicle at CES next week, because I'll be out there. I noticed in the article they're talking about it last week, CES 2015, I think I saw all the cars that were there, and I plan on doing about the same thing this year in 2016. So I doubt I'll get a test drive it, but I'm looking forward to see what they have, to see what's unique about it.
But it's not an autonomous vehicle. Even the pods, that they're saying that this will roll out before you have cars that are fully autonomous, right?
Yeah, but autonomous vehicles are happening much, much faster than the industry thought it was, right? Mm-hmm. When I first started working closely with the auto industry, their predictions were, you know, 2050. Now It's 2020, 2025 on the outside.
Yeah, wow.
So I
was reading
crazy.
An article about Google's cars, how they kept getting in accidents, but apparently when you did the research, it was not the fault of the autonomous car. It was the fault of all the other drivers, because the autonomous car kept following the rules of the road to the letter. And apparently that's what's going on.
And they were driving too slow.
Yeah, like when they were getting on the highways, especially, that's when they would cause the accidents.
I was talking about someone, there was one of the Google cars actually got pulled over for a ticket for something similar. You know, I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was following all the rules to the letter. And when it was pulled over, there were two passengers in the back and the police officer, you know. That vision just kind of made me have to
change.
Well, and see, that's one of the big challenges that they're having, right? Is who's liable?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, the legal aspects are slowing it down compared to the technology, because the car industry, the car manufacturer, right now, every vehicle has a fail safe. It's called the driver. Every function in your car you can override. Right. And so as soon as you can't override it, and this is one of the things Google was complaining, because I can't remember if it was Nevada or California, was saying you have to have a steering wheel, and the driver, the owner of the, or the, whatever you want to call the person who's taking the ride but owns the vehicle.
owner is probably a good
owner word. Works,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That they have to sit behind the wheel and have an override and take over. Well, I would venture to say, given the statistics to date, that more wrecks will be caused when the owner takes over.
No way! I'm not letting you do that.
Right?
Faster!
Yeah.
So how do you set up? Again, it's another business model question. What's the business model? If I, as a manufacturer, can be liable for everybody in all my cars that I sold because the driver takes over at a time when the algorithm would have saved them? Right. And then the driver kills themselves. It's, you know, the ultimate software test again, where they say, you know, you have a choice. You can run off the road and kill a kid, or run into the bus and kill the driver. How do you code that?
Yep.
So do you kill the driver, or do you kill the kid?
Yeah, it's a good point. All the ethics.
Yeah, so it's gonna happen. we're gonna have to do, you know, get out our statistic books and our compasses, right, and say, okay, a 30% chance likely of killing the kid versus a 70% chance of killing the driver, hit the kid.
Yeah.
Is that the right decision?
Phaedra, are you looking forward to the day where you don't have to be, you know, manipulating the brake and the gas and everything?
I feel similarly to the way the other Michael feels. And then one day I know I'm not going to be able to drive. Hopefully that's a long way off. But, yeah. And I like the idea of having that kind of independence. But also I love to drive. Yeah. So it's going to be tough to give it up.
Yeah, me too. I think we're all in the same boat on that one. Yeah.
I really love to drive, so we'll see. We'll see how it all pans out.
So the other thing that we love here, as we kind of round out our show, at least two of us, and I think I can say for all three of us, is coffee.
Mm. I saw that post of you. That was funny.
So one of my boys had pointed me at this website, and it's called Coffeetivity. And the way that this works is, I don't know how they say this, is like, there's so many people who go to a coffee shop and work, and they've gotten kind of used to the white noise, if you will, of the coffee shop, the ambiance. Yeah, exactly. That they want it all the time. And so you can get YouTube videos that will, or audio files that will play sort of the sounds of a coffee shop. We probably could record the sound of our favorite coffee shop, the Bean Traders, too, and maybe we could sell it. Maybe, I don't know.
There's an app for that. The one from Paris. That was funny. There's a Paris bistro sound. You have accordion music in the background or something. I don't know.
And a rude waiter.
No soup for you. Oh, no, wait. Not France.
So, yeah, I'm hearing it right now, and I kind of like it, you know? So it's got lots of different library sounds that you can choose from. And, Michael, I think you said, yeah, no way, no how, this would make me crazy.
No way, no way, how. Yeah. Even when I'm working there, I put my headphones on and I listen to music.
Yeah.
The background noise doesn't turn into background noise to me. It turns into, what are they saying over there? Let me start listening.
And maybe it's the smell of the coffee that allures you to the coffee shop.
You got that,
you know,
right.
Maybe you need like a smelling app.
Yeah. Smell-o-vision.
Smell-o-vision. Smell-o-vision. Oh, well, guys, I think now that we've had our afternoon coffee and we've kind of done the rounds as there were for the year, it's probably that time to say, hey, what are you going to be playing as you ring in the new year? So, Michael, how about you? What are you planning to do?
Well, I'm not playing right now. I'm currently reviewing a book called Learn to Code in Swift by Kevin McNesh.
McNesh.
And I'll be posting a review on that shortly. I'm about 60% my way through. It's my holiday thing to myself. And while reviewing that, I'll be drinking my Merlot-infused coffee that I have a link in the show notes for.
That should be rather interesting, Michael.
Yes.
I just made a grimace. Merlot-infused coffee. I don't know. That mixes two of my favorites. I don't know. Good. Is that like a peanut butter and chocolate or what? I don't know.
Could be. We'll find out. I haven't made my first cup yet.
Okay. Pour it back. Apparently, I'll be playing lots of Lego Dimensions now that I was under the Christmas tree, and I'm going to become an expert in it. So we'll see.
Well, now that I know where it is, Phaedra, you're going to have to lock your door.
Come on over.
Because I'm coming over. I am looking forward to playing a little Settlers of Catan that was underneath the tree for me, for my loving wife. So I'm looking forward to playing that with my kiddos as we determine how to settle this island nation and build the cities that it so richly deserves. So that's my plans for games I'll be playing.
Very nice. Very nice. Yep.
Enjoy.
Well, happy new year to both of you. I've so enjoyed 2015. I can't wait to do 2016 with you guys and see where all of these new ideas and our broadened view of the world take us on Games at Work. Biz.
Sounds good. Same here. Really hope everybody has a safe and fun New Year's Eve. And then afterwards, when you're feeling lousy, you listen to this show.
Like after you've had a lot of Merlot-infused coffee, perhaps?
Yes, yes.
Agreed. Happy 2016, everyone.
All right. See ya.
Bye.
You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network. And we'd like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at gamesatwork_biz or at our website at gamesatwork.biz.